Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 125 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I am a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And joining me is...
This is Michelle Tarbox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology and dermatopathology and interim chair at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Where you're hiring people.
I am indeed. So if you would like to come practice some wonderful general dermatology or surgical dermatology or pediatric dermatology, we would absolutely love to have you. Lubbock is a lovely place to practice. The people here are very friendly and very fond, actually, of the residency program. So it's a great place if you like to teach residents as well.
Cost of living, super cheap, too. Mm-hmm. Well, our mission here on Dermasphere is to update your ears with discussions of some of the latest research in the world of clinical dermatology. And also joining us is the Pimping Bell. Say hello, Pimping Bell. The Pimping Bell chimes whenever we talk about something especially noteworthy, question-worthy, etc. And residency programs, if you pimp your residents, it means you ask them a question. And so the Pimping Bell might have some of these questions that you might want to ask or be asked, depending on your role. So pay attention. Some exciting news here at Dermasphere. There is a group. Is it a group? Is it an actual event? Well, they call themselves the Integrative Dermatology Symposium. Michelle, I think you got a certificate. Am I misremembering that?
I am working on a certificate with them. So that's the Integrative Dermatology Certificate Program. And it helps teach dermatologists about functional medicine and alternative and complementary medicine in ways that are evidence-based that we can utilize in our practice.
So the Integrative Dermatology Symposium, or IDS, likes our podcast, and we like them. So we thought maybe we could have a little partnership when we talk about each other a little bit. So if you listen to their podcast, which is called... I'm sorry, remind me, Michelle.
Learn Skin. It's called Learn Skin.
Then you might hear a little bit about us. And if you listen to us, which you're doing right now, you're going to hear a little bit about them. Are you ready to revolutionize your approach to dermatological care? Well, allow me to introduce the Integrative Dermatology Symposium, IDS, a groundbreaking four-day medical education conference that's redefining conventional limits. IDS is more than just an event. It's a transformative experience. Join the Integrative Dermatology community, fostering collaboration among healthcare professionals and bridging the gap between Western and Eastern modalities. Explore aging, wellness, and integrative aesthetics to develop a more comprehensive approach to patient care. IDS is all about embracing the power of collaboration in healthcare, infusing new ideas and treatment options into the discussion, and contributing to the evolution of whole person care, benefiting every patient. Every patient. Mark your calendars now for IDS 2024, happening in Arlington, Texas, from September 26th to 29th. I believe you can also join virtually. And this is your chance to be part of the future of dermatological care. Early bird pricing ends on April 19th. And my friends, our listeners, can use code DERMASPHERE for 25% off their registration.
So, DERMASPHERE is DERMASPHERE.
Yes. Perhaps we'll see you there. Moving on to our discussions today. First, I'm going to talk about an article from Contact Dermatitis. I believe this was a CertLink article. So if it looks familiar, if you're getting your certification renewed, then that's why. It's called Autoimmune Progesterone Dermatitis, a Systematic Review. Authors include Zoe Lipman and Gil Josipovich. Out of the University of Miami. So this is a systematic review of cases in the literature of this entity called autoimmune progesterone dermatitis, AIPD, which synthesizes 112 articles and 132 cases of this condition. The mean age of onset of this condition was 29, with a range of 12 to 68. So basically, if you menstruate, you might get autoimmune progesterone dermatitis. Condolences. Fortunately, it seems to be rare, though it's likely underreported, and it seems to be a sensitivity to a woman's, or girl's, own progesterone. And if you remember your reproductive endocrinology, which I don't, progesterone rises in the 10 days prior to menses, which is called the luteal phase. I mean, how often do dermatologists have to think about this stuff?
you know, sometimes.
Very rarely, but perhaps if you're worried about this condition. And then progesterone levels fall sharply during and after menses during what's called the follicular phase. So remember, progesterone is progestation. The hormone wants a baby in there, and it does what it can to help support potential babies. And so it rises before your period, and then it goes down afterward. And we still don't know why this autoimmune progesterone dermatitis thing happens, and I wonder if autoimmune could be a bit of a misnomer. But the theories mostly focus on how a woman could become sensitized to her own progesterone. How does that happen? Well, they say perhaps through super high levels of progesterone, like during pregnancy. Remember, it's progestation. Perhaps from endogenous sources, like OCPs. Perhaps from cross-reactivity to other sorts of steroid medications that somebody may have taken. Nobody knows, but those are some pretty decent thoughts, and it's possible that it's, like, different for different people. The clinical manifestations are quite varied. This report found 14 different morphologies reported, with urticaria being the most common in half of the patients. Other presentations in most to least reported, remember this doesn't necessarily mean actually happens in clinical practice the most, because case reports tend to skew toward more obscure presentations, but still. So again, urticaria most common, followed by erythema multiforme, then maculopapular eruption, vesicular eruptions, fixed drug eruption, eczematous dermatitis, nonspecific erythematous violaceous plaque-like rash.
It rolls off the tongue.
Yep. Then purpura and petechiae, then stomatitis, angioedema and edema, erythromelalgia, dermatitis herpetiformis-like, erythema annulare-like, and necrolytic migratory erythema.
Yikes.
Pretty wild. They also comment anaphylaxis. I assume that falls into the edema / angioedema category. But that sucks! Getting anaphylaxis to your own progesterone? Where's the justice?
Yeah, it's very difficult. Have you ever had a patient with this?
Yes, I have.
Me too. Mine was vesiculating, so she made these plaques of little microvesicles all over her face for the last half of her menstrual cycle. It was very challenging to manage.
Well, it can look like just about anything. So how do you figure out that that's this thing? Well, most patients reported in the literature said that the onset of their manifestations occurred within 10 days of menses and then remitted afterward. And they had similar lesions each time it happened, and the same anatomic regions were affected each time, which was usually most of the body, which lends support to the idea that this is a systemic sensitization, and it was almost always itchy. So some recurrent itchy skin thing on a woman that tends to recur, and on questioning, it's like, oh yeah, maybe this is kind of every month. Maybe it is kind of right before my period. Should really get your antenna up. So a good history and physical exam could get you to the diagnosis, and then often there's confirmatory intradermal or intramuscular progesterone challenge. And shout out, we've got a couple people at our institution who do this test. It actually doesn't sound that hard. You just have to have the right ingredients and know what you're doing. This article sort of lays out how to do it. You just inject a little bit of progesterone into the dermis with positive and negative controls, and you slowly increase the concentration and see if they react. However, there's some new research that apparently suggests the high false positive rate of the progesterone challenge in some healthy controls, though the authors note that some new tests may be available soon. They also say that other tests are unlikely to be of much value, unless you need to rule out some other disease that could also be hormonally sensitive, like lupus, for example. So biopsy could show you changes of lupus, whereas it's pretty nonspecific for autoimmune progesterone dermatitis. And speaking of this, if you think your patient may have autoimmune progesterone dermatitis, you should also consider other diseases that can be hormonally sensitive, like lupus or atopic dermatitis, and also think about things that people might do around their menses, like take NSAIDs for cramps, for example. Maybe they're getting urticaria from their ibuprofen. So if you think somebody has this, you might want to treat them. They probably want you to. Nothing is considered standard of care, though in these cases reported, the most successful treatments were those that suppressed ovulation, especially surgery. Ma'am, can I interest you in an oophorectomy and hysterectomy to control your autoimmune progesterone dermatitis?
Goodness.
And OCPs, that's a lot easier for me to prescribe. interestingly, there was no comment, at least in these case reports, on like IUDs or implanted hormonal contraceptives like the Nexplanon, vaginal rings. We've got a lot of options these days, so I'm guessing that some of these are going to end up being potentially helpful. The authors do point out that steroids and antihistamines were often trialed, but were pretty unhelpful, especially steroids. Antihistamines may be at least worth a shot. Some people got some improvement. And if you don't want to take OCPs and you want to keep your ovaries and uterus, perhaps you want to get pregnant in the next month or two. What are your options? Well, progesterone sensitization may be an option for some patients. That's something you might do through an allergist or a knowledgeable dermatologist, because, like, you're married to an allergist, Michelle. My understanding is that if he really felt like it, he could desensitize someone to penicillin-type medicines. Probably he could do the same thing for progesterone.
So the desensitization protocols typically involve exposure of the patient to, in first, very, very small quantities of the sensitized agent, and then gradually and progressively increasing the amount. They do this with all sorts of things, even including peanut antigen. And there are some patients that are on a maintenance protocol where they have to eat a peanut a day, so that, not so that they can eat peanuts in the future, but so that they don't die if someone around them eats peanuts. And basically, you work the patient up from very, very small amounts of peanut allergen to finally the point where they can maintain on their own. But they have to continue to have the exposure so their immune system continues to tolerate that particular sensitized substance.
Well, there are case reports of that being helpful for this condition, though it's kind of weird that your body doesn't just do that. Like, don't women have at least some progesterone floating around?
Yeah, I think the hypothesis is the change, right? The change in the amount of progesterone circulating. And in my experience, I've found that monophasic birth control pills are superior to treating progesterone dermatitis versus the kind that kind of mimic the normal endogenous hormonal cycling, like a tricyclic oral contraceptive, like orthotricycline or something like that, where it sort of changes over the period of the menses.
So you're talking about progesterone-only pills?
No, just ones that have a steady dose. That are estrogen and progesterone, but it's the same dose throughout the month, instead of the kind that change over the course.
Gotcha. Well, I usually prescribe Yaz or Yasmin for my patients with, like, acne, for example, because I think it's drospirenone is the progesterone in there, and that's been sort of shown to be the best for those conditions. Would either of those fall into this category of consistent medications? Those would be good.
That's actually one of my go-tos for this particular condition, is something in that family with drospirenone as a progesterone.
All right. And the occasional patient may spontaneously remit. That's the story. Pay attention. You can really help people out and look real smart. Two of my favorite things.
Looking smart and helping people. I love that.
I should get a t-shirt. We should get Dermosphere t-shirts.
Dermosphere
t-shirts. Looking smart and helping people.
See, I like this idea, Luke. That sounds like quite the slogan. Well, if you have ever been faced with keratosis pilaris in clinic, you have probably felt not terribly smart, because it is so dadgum difficult to treat. Now, keratosis pilaris rubra is a subset of keratosis pilaris that tends to present with the sort of grainy follicular papules on a background of confluent erythema. And often this is that chronic fleshy blushy change that affects the cheeks of young patients, usually adolescents or teenagers. It can also involve the upper extremities and can be quite persistent there. And when you're dealing with keratosis pilaris rubra, it tends to persist beyond puberty, unlike typical keratosis pilaris, which typically improves after a patient goes through puberty. So if you've ever been in that circumstances, then boy, have these authors got an article for you. So this is a lovely article out of Pediatric Dermatology by chief authors Alexandra Ekberg and Shilag McGinnis, which is a very cool name. I wonder if it's Irish. It looks like an Irish
Sheila.
Name.
Sheila McGinnis.
Sheila. Sorry, it's spelled very uniquely. She has a beautiful name. So Sheila McGinnis. Do you know Sheila?
She's a pediatric dermatologist, and the world is small. She gave us a couple talks. She seems very nice. I inherited one of her patients, and she had done a lot of work on that patient, which made my job very easy.
Well, and McGinnis is a fun last name if you're person of Irish heritage as well. And they are from the University of Iowa Department of Dermatology. And here they present a case report of a 15-year-old boy who had keratosis pilaris rubra that they successfully treated with topical sirolimus. So as we know, this condition is difficult to treat. Topical therapeutics are often trialed, such as emollients, keratolytics, corticosteroids, and retinoids, although these are not uniformly effective and, in my experience, usually underwhelming in their improvement for this condition. Pulse dye laser has been found to be therapeutically successful for treating this. I think the biggest adverse effect that you run into with the pulse dye laser is the maintenance contract, because they are about $5,000 a year to maintain most of the time. If anyone in the dermosphere has any ideas about how to have a pulse dye laser that you don't have a very expensive contract for every year after you purchase the device, I would be all ears. So the authors here looked at the vascular pathology as a part of this keratosis pilaris rubra and hypothesized that they could potentially utilize sirolimus cream as a treatment. So there's a couple of different entities in the differential for keratosis pilaris rubra, including erythromelanosis follicularis facii et coleae, which can be differentiated from keratosis pilaris rubra by its erythema, and from keratosis pilaris atrophicans because of its lack of atrophy. So the keratosis pilaris atrophicans can happen in a syndromic fashion. Do you remember some of the syndromes that happens with Luke?
Of course I do. I want to see if you remember them.
Awesome sauce. So Rombo syndrome is one of those that can give you a kind of an atrophoderma on the face, can also have hypertrichosis and hypodontia, and those patients can also have, isn't that one of the ones where they can get more than your average number of trichoepitheliomas, I believe? I believe that is correct.
Definitely trust your memory.
So I believe that that's correct. But you are dealing instead in this case with the keratosis rubra pilaris. So we have our case report of the 15-year-old boy. He had a history of atopic dermatitis. He'd been presenting for evaluation of this worsening erythema and bumps on the cheeks and upper extremities associated with a burning sensation and worsened by wind and flushing. So they had already trialed ammonium lactate 12% and tretinoin microsphere gel without improvement. The physical presentation was characteristic with small monomorphic papules with surrounding prominent erythema and some telangiectasias, which coalesced into large erythematous vascular patches on the bilateral cheeks going down the neck. The similar eruption was also present on his bilateral arms and his legs. So there had been case reports of topical sirolimus being useful for superficial vascular anomalies, as well as case reports of successful treatment of keratosis pilaris rubra with pulse dye laser. So the authors wanted to trial treatment of KPR with topical sirolimus 1% cream prescribed twice daily and provided through a compounding pharmacy. And I think Chemistry RX is one of the compounding pharmacies that makes a sirolimus compounded topical that is not inexpensive, but is not unobtainable. The patient was treated for 18 months and returned for follow-up with near complete resolution of his facial and neck erythema. He also had decrease in the burning symptoms, and the photographs presented in the article are quite striking. So if the authors give us permission, we might be able to share those. The patient was able to improve in 2 months with twice daily application, and he had then been able to sustain the results with once daily application to the face for several months. He didn't have any adverse events, and his serum sirolimus level was less than 3 nanograms per milliliter, which is considered clinically insignificant. He was then given a trial discontinuation of the topical sirolimus cream and then switched to treating the arms with a plan for close follow-up. Keratosis pilaris rubra is a somewhat underrecognized variant of KP, but we've all seen it. It's that sort of bright red erythema. It's usually, I see it more in teenage boys. Do you see it more in teenage boys, Luke?
I think I see it in adolescents of all stripes. It seems to be mostly adolescents.
And it can be quite uncomfortable for the patients, often can be associated with a stinging sensation. We don't really understand the pathophysiology of this condition, but we believe it's partially due to abnormal keratinization of the follicular epithelium and then resultant inflammation. It's often cosmetically bothersome for patients as well as causing discomfort, and treatment is difficult. Many things have been trialed, keratolytics, corticosteroids, vitamin D analogs, retinoids. I've trialed all of those things in patients with this condition. Pulse dye laser has been reported to be beneficial, which is thought to be due to apoptosis of the vascular endothelial cells and a decrease in vascular endothelial growth factor levels. So sirolimus is a macrolide. It is derived from Streptomyces hygroscopicus, and it has anti-tumor, anti-proliferative, and immunosuppressive properties. It is used to prevent allograft rejection, as well as other complex immune syndromes are also sometimes managed with sirolimus. And how it works is it interacts with intracellular binding protein FK, and I looked everywhere to figure out what FK stands for. If anyone can find that, I will personally send you a pen because I cannot find what FK stands for. But this is intercellular binding FK protein to form the sirolimus FKBP complex. And the complex leads to suppression of mTOR expression. As we know, mTOR is important for cell cycle progression. So it halts cell cycle progression from the G1 to the S phase in numerous cell types. So systemic sirolimus's job is to take care of hyperactive immune responses or suppress immune responses to transplanted organs. Similarly to the systemic utilization, topical administration can lead to local inhibition of vascular smooth muscle and endothelial cell proliferation, as well as decreasing inflammation. Systemic sirolimus has a lot of applications, including off-label use to slow the progression of plexiform neurofibromas in neurofibromatosis type 1. It's also been used as an off-label treatment for scleromyxedema, dermatomyositis, GVHD, and Kaposi sarcoma. And pediatric dermatologists are probably familiar with topical or systemic sirolimus because it can be used to treat different vascular tumors, can also be used topically to treat the facial angiofibromas of tuberous sclerosis, and is quite useful for that. It's emerging as well as a therapy for a variety of vascular anomalies. The efficacy and safety of sirolimus treating these vascular anomalies has found that patients treated with topical or oral sirolimus can get benefit, but only those who get oral sirolimus experienced adverse side effects, which can include oral mucositis, dyslipidemia, leukopenia, and potentially infectious complications. There was a review of patients that were given topical sirolimus. After looking at these 56 patients who get topical sirolimus, only two had detectable blood levels, both of which had capillary malformations, which may have had increased uptake of the medication. There was no change in management for those patients, and they did well in the study. It's not clear whether we need to do regular lab monitoring if we're using topical sirolimus, and we especially, I think, would consider the surface area. I did find it interesting in the case report that when the patient was done treating the face, they stopped treatment there and moved on to the arms and didn't treat multiple areas at the same time, probably to decrease the potential for absorption. And that's something that I think does need to be taken into consideration, the body area surface involved, the application frequency, patient characteristics, and possibly the characteristics of what you're applying it to. But in this case study, topical sirolimus was effective at reducing erythema and symptoms related to keratosis pilaris rubra for 1 year without side effects. So this might provide support for the use of topical sirolimus as a novel therapy for keratosis pilaris rubra and potentially other vasculoproliferative conditions.
Yeah, interesting to have an option for this. Mm-hmm. They said that he decreased his treatment to daily, and then he was advised to discontinue it and close follow-up. It'd be kind of nice if they were able to publish the close follow-up so that we could see if he was able to just stop it and maintain clearance. Mm-hmm. They didn't mention oxymetazoline cream, which is often sort of where I go if patients want to try something for sort of anything pink and flushy, blushy on the skin. It's super pricey if you buy the sort of the brand name Rofade, but you can often get it compounded. There's a compounding pharmacy here that'll mix it up for like $45, which is pretty good. It's not a permanent solution, of course. It works for like 8 to 12 hours. But sirolimus, I think most pediatric dermatologists consider it pretty safe, especially when applied to a relatively small surface area. You can get sirolimus 1% cream compounded by some of these specialty pharmacies like Chemistry RX or Custom Scripts is another one that we use. And it's not real cheap. It's probably like $200, but still, it's not too bad. There is a commercially available sirolimus 0.2% gel that's now approved for the angiofibromas associated with tuberous sclerosis. The brand is Hyftor, H-Y-F-T-O-R. So that's good, and I'm glad the pharmaceutical company did the trials to get it approved, but it definitely wins the prize for most expensive topical medication we have available. A 10-gram tube is $1,800.
Oh, wow. That is pricey.
But I should remember sirolimus because I forget about it. And kudos to one of my residents. I'm sorry, I forget who it was who found this article when we had a patient who had this condition and wanted something to do about it.
There are some longevity telemedicine platforms that are also selling topical rapamycin cream. And I do wonder if that's going to become an avenue for some patients to obtain some of these medications, because the commercial world is starting to pick up some of our medications in dermatology. There's a company called Muesli that, since Vanico stopped being produced, has started to make an eflornithine oxidase cream for patients with facial hirsutism, for example. So I wonder if that might not potentially provide some competition to give some pricing advantage for some of these patients that need to use these topicals lifelong, like our patients with tuberous sclerosis.
So do people just buy it online through one of these platforms, or do they need a prescription?
They do a like one of those digital doctor visit things, I think is how these platforms typically work. And, you know, I'm not mad at it if it can get people the topical eflornithine oxidase to use for the facial hirsutism, because Vanek is a good topical, but I had a very difficult time getting patients that product to use just because of the cost and the lack of coverage by insurance.
Well, spironolactone's cheap. So let's talk about that one, I guess.
Nice segue. Well done, Luke. I'm proud of you. That was slick.
So this is like the women's health version of the Dermosphere podcast. We had all that menopause discussion some time ago, too. So This is from JAMA Dermatology. It's called Association of Spironolactone Use with Risk of Cancer, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. The authors include Conti Bombaretti and John Barberi. We saw Dr. Barberi talk when we were at the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar last year and sat next to him at one of the lunches or something. He's one of my new heroes. He's a great guy. Like me, he's like an isotretinoin proponent and minimalist in terms of labs. So I like people who think the things I think are correct. Go figure. The authors are from all over, but University of Miami and Brigham and Women's were sort of the first and senior authors. So apparently, spironolactone. I didn't know this, but it carries an FDA-mandated warning that it has been associated with an increased risk of cancer and, quote, unnecessary use should be avoided. Looks like these warnings were based mostly on animal studies that used doses 150 times higher than human doses. And these animal studies were associated with, quote, adenomas. So not even cancer. Adenomas in the animals. But we like spironolactone. I like spironolactone.
I agree.
In dermatology, we use it for quite a few things. Acne, hidradenitis suppurativa, androgenetic alopecia, hirsutism, perhaps for gender-affirming care as well. The authors mentioned specifically that it may be a good alternative to PO antibiotics for acne. And they also note that PO antibiotics may be associated with an increased risk of breast and colon cancers, at least in some studies. So Dr. Barberi is also like a let's get away from antibiotics for acne kind of guy, which I think makes a lot of sense. So this is a systematic review and meta-analysis of seven studies that collectively looked at about 4.5 million individuals across six continents. One of these big data studies. The number of individuals in each study ranged from a paltry 18,000 to over 2 million. And after crunching the numbers, these authors found a lot of good news. Spironolactone was associated with a decreased risk of prostate cancer. The odds ratio was 0.7, meaning if you had taken spironolactone, you were like 70% as likely to get prostate cancer versus like 100% if you hadn't. So it's protective perhaps at a 30% degree, though I'm not going to be prescribing spironolactone to anybody with a prostate. And they found that it was not associated with an increase or decrease risk in cancers of the breast, ovary, kidney, bladder, stomach, or esophagus. Their study involved a lot of pretty intense statistics that, again, I'm not a statistician, but as far as I could tell, those statistics seem to be necessary in order to compare all of these studies and pool the data. In addition to all of that, they also include what they call a narrative review, where they basically report other non-associations that other studies have uncovered, showing also that spironolactone does not appear to be associated with an increased risk of cancers of the thyroid, endometrium, cervix, colorectum, pancreas, or pharynx, or with leukemia, at least the myelomonoblastic myelomonocytic type. So that's all good news. It doesn't seem to be associated with increased risk of cancer of the anything, and potentially can be protective for prostate cancer. Why would you give somebody with a prostate this medicine? Well, you were probably a cardiologist or something. Spironolactone exerts antagonistic effects on the androgen and progesterone receptors, and it is FDA approved for heart failure, edema, ascites, hypertension, and primary aldosteronism. There are definitely some limitations to this study, the most notable of which is that the, quote, certainty of evidence is considered low or very low. This seems to be related to various statistical methods, including pooling the data, but the numbers of participants are so high. I mean, it's hard to believe that this certainty of evidence could be low. Other limitations, most of the individuals included were European and were predominantly of older age, like age 65 plus, but you think that would actually be kind of a benefit because then that's an enriched population for certain cancers. And then the authors say they weren't able to determine if there was a dose-dependent effect. So kind of good news for spironolactone, and we've talked about spironolactone quite a bit on this podcast. So for example, you can check out some of our previous episodes. In episode 7, we talked about spironolactone plus trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole can lead to severe complications, including death. So don't give those two to the same person. In episode 8, we talked that spironolactone is okay to use in breast cancer patients, so sort of a prequel to this one. In episode 11, we said, don't worry about hyperkalemia unless the patient is over 40 years or over. I have some colleagues who just don't worry about hyperkalemia with spironolactone at all. In episode 78, we talked about spironolactone for androgenetic alopecia. The upshot was you need fairly high doses, like 150 to 200 milligrams a day, but it can be effective. And in episode 98, we even discussed that spironolactone may be safe in pregnancy. But, you know, read that article and go in with your eyes open if you're going to go that route. I still tell people not to get pregnant on the medicine.
Yes, I think that's probably the wisest thing. There's so many complexities to forming a brand new human that any way we can decomplicate that process, I think, is always a good idea, so long as it doesn't prevent the patient from having a therapy they genuinely need.
So I personally have gotten farther and farther away from like doxycycline for acne, for example, in the 5-ish years I've been in attending. And I feel like that just represents dermatology as a whole, probably just because isotretinoin is just such a safe and effective drug. And then spironolactone, also good. OCP is pretty good. So we have a lot of good options. And if you're talking antibiotic stewardship, I think the choice is fairly clear. And obviously, doxycycline and minocycline and all the other things we can use have potentially severe complications as well. I had a patient recently get SJS from doxycycline. What the heck?
Gosh.
I've never had anyone get SJS from isotretinoin.
Me neither. I have not.
I mean, I've had people have potentially serious side effects from isotretinoin, but again, the mood stuff we've talked about, and if somebody has to be hospitalized for psychiatric disturbances and they are also on isotretinoin, it's hard to say how much the isotretinoin played a role, of course. Anyway, big isotretinoin fan, also like spironolactone. More good news.
I agree. I think that, you know, that medication can be life-altering for patients. And a lot of times the step therapy that we're required to go through can prevent them from getting more acute control over a condition that leaves footprints. You know, the scarring that can be caused by acne can be very difficult to treat and is never really completely reversible. So I do think that efforts to minimize that are always a good idea.
Yeah. What are we talking about next?
Well, next, Luke, we're going to talk about dupilumab. And
another
spoiler,
one of my favorite medicines.
I know. And I would like you to get out your tissue box because I'm going to give you some bad news. But I want to couch. I know. I want to couch this in the understanding that this is a generally very, very safe medication. But there are some unique potential side effects that we do need, I think, to be aware of as a group of doctors that heavily utilizes this medication and this class of medication. So we have an article out of the JID, so buckle up because these are always heavy science articles. The article is entitled T-helper to IL-4-IL-13 dual blockade with dupilumab is linked to some emergent T-helper 17 type diseases, including seronegative arthritis and enthesitis enthesopathy, but not to humoral autoimmune diseases. And the chief authors are Charlie Bridgewood and Dennis McGonigal. I hope he's a professor because then he's Professor McGonigal and that would just make my heart happy. So in this article, they discuss the fact that dupilumab as an IL-4, IL-13 blocker has been linked to emergent seronegative inflammatory arthritis and psoriasis, which is part of the spondyloarthropathy syndrome spectrum, which includes
Stop there for a sec. So we probably need the bell for dupilumab blocks IL-4 and 13.
I always forget to ring the bell for myself. I need to send you a bell so we can ring for each other.
And has been linked to some bad things, inflammatory arthritis and psoriasis. Uncool. I assume we'll talk more about the potential linkage.
So to determine this, they used something called Vigibase. And Vigibase sounds like a Pokemon. It's like Pokemon morph into Vigibase. But Vigibase is a pharmacovigilance database that is sponsored by the World Health Organization. And it's a place where you can report adverse drug reactions. The kind of you have some mining of bioinformatic databases as well as repositories that have created this dupilumab-related immunopharmacovigilance with molecular cascades relevant to reported findings to kind of go over this data. They found 37,000 plus reports of dupilumab adverse drug reactions with skin, eye, and musculoskeletal symptoms most affected. And seronegative arthritis with an odds ratio of 9.61, psoriasis with an odds ratio of 1.48, and enthesitis enthesopathy with an odds ratio of 12.65, and then finally erysipelas with an odds ratio of 3.77 were highly associated by analysis of the likelihood of attributability of the effect to the medication. That's done through something called an information quotient. Sorry about that. It is a number that kind of looks at the likelihood that a medication caused an adverse event that you are looking at. So the IC0.25 level is what's usually utilized to determine if a medication might be responsible for an adverse outcome. Now, on the positive side, ankylosing spondylitis and inflammatory bowel disease were not conducively associated with dupilumab use, and the classic polygenic humoral-mediated autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis or systemic lupus erythematosus were not associated with dupilumab, and in fact might actually be protected against by dupilumab use. The analysis also looked at the biological pathways potentially involved with dupilumab-associated adverse drug reactions, including the fibroblast growth factor receptor family 2 pathway. They also looked at microRNA analysis. Now, microRNAs are something that are a little bit, they're kind of a cool thing, honestly, because when we think of our genome as humans, we think of our chromosomes being kind of it, right? We think that's our genome. Our chromosomes, the DNA that we have in that area, that's our genome. But our genome is much more dynamic than just the chromosomes we inherited from our parents. And microRNAs, which are circulating RNAs, account for between 1 and 5% of the human genome total. And they actually regulate up to 30% of protein coding genes. They regulate those by attaching to coding sequences and usually negatively regulating the transcription of protein coding genes. And so in this analysis, they also looked at microRNA, specifically HSA-MIR21-5P and HSA-MIR335-5P.
These are some of my favorites.
I know. I mean, they're like the top hits. It's like, you know, we've got U2 and we have HSA-MIR215P. So these negatively regulate and help modulate control over things like cancer and inflammation, and their pathway could be involved with the dupilumab observed effects in this study. They did find also that the dupilumab use can skew immune responses toward IL-23, IL-17 cytokine pathway related diseases like psoriasis. And IL-4, IL-13 also plays a role in homeostatic tissue repair. So there is a potential link with ocular and arterial pathology, and the arterial pathology is specifically in elderly patients. Any patient over 75, you do want to be thoughtful about the possibility of that. So we'll get a little bit into the details now that we've got the broad overview. One thing I want to start with is explaining what enthesitis is, because I feel like as a resident, I heard that term tossed around a lot and never really completely understood what it was. So entheses are the sites where either tendons or ligaments attach to bone. So it's where something attaches something else to a bone. If you have a ligament, it is attaching a bone to a bone. When I was studying this, when I was in gross anatomy, I kind of thought about ligaments locking things in place, because your ligaments bone to bone are things that generally don't move as much as like a tendon. And a tendon attaches your tender meat to your skeleton, you see. So you wouldn't use tenderizer on bone, but you would on meat, and meat is muscle, so your tender meat is attached to your bones by your tendons. But both tendons and ligamentous attachments are entheses, and so enthesitis is inflammation of that attachment point, and that can present in a lot of the conditions that we treat, like psoriasis or ankylosing spondylitis. So that is sometimes, I think, a helpful thing to clarify. The background data about kind of how and why the medication could be connected to changing the inflammatory pathway does kind of make sense. We know that when we push on, block, or alter the expression of one kind of pathway in a cell, we may, in sort of like a seesaw manner, unsettle, unbalance, or promote another pathway. And that can happen when you're blocking IL-4/13. you can create potentially a skewing towards IL-23, IL-17 immunity. There's some important things that they bring forward in the analysis portion, including something called the Weber effect. So I had to read about this because this was not something that I had previously encountered, but basically
I assume that it is about Spider-Man.
I mean, how did you know, Luke? Like, I'm not surprised at all that you know that. So the Weber effect is actually a phenomenon of an increased volume of reported adverse events of new drugs within their first several years after approval. Older drugs have been around longer and clinicians don't feel the need to report these adverse events as much. But when a new drug comes out and something weird happens, it's more likely that that's going to get reported, especially in the immediate wake of the introduction of that medication to the public.
Spider-Man is so interested in protecting the public that he's paying attention to all these adverse reactions when the drugs come out and getting on his laptop and typing in all the problems.
See, you know, I mean, you know, Spider-Man out there solving the world's problems. So Spider-Man would like this. I like this part. So let's start with the good news. Dupilumab is not linked to classic polygenic humoral mediated autoimmune diseases like lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, scleroderma, and other things. So actually, the odds ratio for those humoral type of autoimmune diseases was 0.60. And remember, when you have an odds ratio that's less than one, that's a reduction of risk. The confidence interval for that was 0.38 to 0.96. It did not capture one. So that does indicate that you might have some protective effect against humoral immunity, which is nice. It's not correlation is not causation. That's true. And I did say might.
So maybe the people who tend to get the diseases for which they need dupilumab are somehow less likely to get these other ones or something.
I don't know. I feel like atopic people are autoimmune at baseline, but you may be right there as well. And we always have to think about these things. That's why we get some strange signals, I think, with Accutane, with isotretinoin, is because patients who have severe enough acne to really need Accutane often have some systemic inflammation sort of predisposition in their bodies.
Also, there's some selection bias for drug reactions that get reported to this database.
That is true. But I'm trying to highlight the positive things, so that could be nice.
I appreciate that.
Well, thank you.
I do love dupilumab.
Because we stand dupilumab in this place, so we do like to look at this. Now, we know that IL-4, IL-13 may actually play a role in restraining psoriatic inflammation. In fact, so much so that a couple decades ago, when we were trying to make new medications for psoriasis, there was a recombinant IL-4 that actually showed improvement in PASI scores. It never made it as a therapeutic, but that was something that was at one point studied because IL-4, IL-13 has a negative effect on psoriatic type inflammation. So when we block those things, we may be sort of tipping the scale a little bit towards patients having more psoriasis-like inflammation. And I think that this is something that's just going to kind of help guide our choices in the future. The most likely involved conditions that could be potentially predisposed by treating a patient with dupilumab or might be connected with that use included the challenges with seronegative arthritis, psoriasis, as we discussed, and then the enthesitis, enthesopathy, and iridocyclitis. The eye effect also is a little bit more complicated for two reasons. So as we know, one of the complicating issues we run into sometimes when we're treating patients with dupilumab can be conjunctivitis. Conjunctivitis can make the eyeball itchy. When patients are itchy, they scratch or rub. Because IL-4, IL-13 can also be important in maintaining tissues, when you have chronic damage to the tissues of the cornea, for example, because of rubbing and pressure, and then you might have slightly impaired healing of that process, keratoconus may be increased, maybe have an increased risk. And so I think that is something that we could potentially see a slight increased risk with treatment with the dupilumab.
What's keratoconus?
Keratoconus, it's terrifying to look at. So if you look at a picture of it, it looks kind of like the cornea is shaped like one of the cups of the Madonna bra when she was in that like pointy like a virgin Madonna bra stage, you know what I'm saying? Or the Pope's
hat. Very
nice
reference.
A little bit. Oh, thank you. It's a bit dated, but I think it still checks out. So those changes can happen in the eye. And then I think very importantly to pull out of this paper is the increased risk of aortic aneurysms in patients over 75 years of age, specifically because of the influence that the IL-4, IL-13 axis can have on tissue repair. And so one of the issues we always run into with powerful medications is finding balance. and making sure that we are using these medications thoughtfully and selecting the medications for patients appropriately. And I think that this will inform my utilization of this medication. I think that it is important to discuss with patients over the age of 75 that there is potentially some increased risk of aortic aneurysm, especially if that patient is high risk for other reasons, like they have chronic unmanaged hypertension, or they've had a problem with an aortic aneurysm in the past. That might be something important to consider when you're choosing medications to treat the patient, especially as we are now in an era where we have more choices for how to take care of things that are as challenging to treat as atopic dermatitis. But I think that overall, I'm still quite comfortable using the medication. It's helpful to know that these pathways can kind of push on and skew each other. I think we've all also seen TNF-alpha induced lupus type eruptions, which is the other side of the seesaw. You know, when we push on one pathway, we can unbalance another pathway because everything is so interconnected in our physiology. And I think that having this information will help us choose the medication most appropriate for each patient. I do like the modulation of the microRNAs and kind of talking about that, just because it's sort of a cool way that our genome regulates itself through these microRNAs that circulate and form up to 5% of our genome. The ones that they looked at specifically, again, these the greatest hits, second only to U2, HSA-MIR21-5P and HSA-MIR335-5P have been linked to regulating things like immune responses, including IL-12 and interferon 1 production, as well as regulating the TH17 response. And the HSA-MIR215P has actually been identified as a major driver of psoriasis and psoriatic arthritis. So modulation of that by manipulation of the IL-4, IL-13 pathway is something to pay some attention to. What are your thoughts, Luke?
An important question that I don't think this study can answer just because of the way it was designed is, does this stuff go away when the patient stops dupilumab?
I think that's a very good question. After reading over the article, I feel like there's probably not data captured in a way that would help us determine this yet. But I think it's something that can be on the radar moving forward because of greater awareness of this. I think this would also be a good utilization of something called Dataderm, which if you don't know what Dataderm is, it's a pretty cool way for dermatologists to share information about patient care. It's sponsored through the AAD, I believe. And yes, it's through the AAD. And it's a clinical data registry that would help to improve quality of care, optimize practice efficiency, and facilitate health services research. And I think that this is a place where potentially that question could be answered over time.
We talked about this potential enthesitis association once upon a time back in episode 63. And I've looked at one or two, I think, case reports about these issues, and it looks pretty good. Like, I feel like I remember that these issues do get better in the reported cases when patients have stopped dupilumab. Mm-hmm. Of course, if you had a tendon rupture or something, then it's just not going back. But still, I really like dupilumab. It's a very safe and effective medicine. I wish all of our medicines were as safe and effective. It is expensive, as everything is, but there's plenty of medicines that are not as effective that are pricier than it is. So I'm a pretty big dupilumab fan.
Me too.
But this is, you know, a reason to not be too cavalier about it. And if you have a patient and you're like, man, I could probably get this patient clear with topicals, but dupilumab just so easy. Well, this is an argument to say to the family, you know, we do have other powerful medicines for atopic dermatitis, but they have potential side effects associated with them. So I prefer not to use them if we can at all avoid it, which we probably all are thinking anyway, but I feel that with the advent of dupilumab, we've been a lot more ready to pull the trigger on a systemic medication for atopic dermatitis.
I do think that, you know, as we understand these medications better, we'll get to know and love them warts and all. And every treatment that works is going to have some unintended effect in the body because every system in our body is just so beautifully connected. We love these pathways where we like to draw a nice straight line down and it's one protein interacts with another protein, interacts with another protein. But the fact is that our physiology is very parsimonious. And so a lot of things play a role in multiple different pathways. And when you push on a certain element of one pathway, it might unbalance or redistribute the effect of another.
Well, we might love our medicines warts and all. Do we also love them molluscum and all?
Ooh. I think
perhaps
so.
Perhaps not. But we got time for one more article here, which is indeed about molluscum. It's called Berdazimer Gel for Molluscum Contagiosum, an integrated analysis of three randomized controlled trials published in the JAD. Authors include Jeffrey Sugarman, Tomoko Maeda Chubachi, Amy Poller, big pediatric dermatology heavy hitter, also on the article.
Woo-woo!
Out of UCSF, UT Health, Northwestern, George Washington. And then, of course, this is sponsored by the company that makes this drug, Novan. So, listeners, do you hate molluscum? If so, yeah. You have something in common with a lot of my patients' parents. And I guess a lot of other people. There's been some interest lately in getting drugs approved to treat this common, not dangerous, and spontaneously resolving condition. For example, in episode 114, we discussed the trials that got approved a drug device combination called YCANTH. It's a cantharidin-containing product. You're supposed to keep it in your clinic and treat your patients with it. The short story with that one is that it's an approved version of cantharidin. If you feel like you want to use cantharidin for molluscum, which I generally don't, it's very expensive. But this study we're talking about today is a trial that led to the approval of another new medicine for molluscum. That's right, two medicines for molluscum approved within a year of each other. This one is called Berdazimer, possibly Berdazimer. Berdazimer? I'm going to go Berdazimer. It's not yet commercially available, so you can't prescribe it for your patients, but it's expected to come out later this year. So Berdazimer releases nitric oxide, which has antimicrobial and antiviral activity. And this is the first-in-class medication of this type. So I like that. Kudos to the drug company for trying something new. These guys ran two clinical trials in 35 sites in the United States. And these led to positive trends, but were not quite statistically significant in terms of their p-values. So they ran a final, even bigger trial at 55 sites across the United States. Altogether, they had 1,600 patients who were randomized to Berdazimer or to vehicle. If your goal is complete clearance of molluscum at week 12 after daily application of this stuff, well, that happened 30% of the time in the Berdazimer group and 20% of the time in the placebo group. Which isn't really groundbreaking. 12 weeks of 3 months, 30% of the time versus 20% of the time. I calculated a number needed to treat of 10, if you're comparing it to its vehicle anyway. There is some intensive subgroup analysis in the study, so kudos to the authors for including all of that stuff. And if you take all of the statistics at face value, the medication seems to work a lot better in some groups than in others, though I think we know that subgroup analysis kind of has its limitations. We talk a lot about the odds ratio on this podcast, the OR. We've talked about it already a couple times for a couple of our other studies. So basically, the odds ratio is what are the odds of an outcome compared to the placebo or the vehicle. And then there's a confidence interval. So we recall that in statistics, the statistical analyses we do produces a number for this odds ratio. The odds ratio is 2. You're 2 times more likely to have the outcome compared to if you didn't. But we don't know that the number is 2, but we can be 95% confident that it's between blah and blah. That's called the confidence interval. And if that confidence interval includes the number 1, like we previously mentioned, then that basically means that there's no change, or at least within our 95% confidence of what the actual number is, there's a reasonable chance that there's like not a difference between the two approaches. So, in terms of complete clearance then, the following subgroups had responses that suggested that vehicle and drug were equivalent. Kids age 2 to 6, kids age 12 to 18, Black or African American patients, patients with a history of atopic dermatitis, and patients who had a treatment interruption. That's a lot of subgroups where the odds ratio included 1. Conversely, the medication seemed to work better, so the ORs were even higher and did not include 1, in the following groups. Kids age 6 to 12, white people, and in patients with no history of atopic dermatitis. The authors do acknowledge these issues, and they point out that some subgroups, such as teenagers and Black patients, perhaps did not achieve, quote, statistically robust complete response rates. They speculate that this could be due to small sample size, though the sample sizes were 71 and 90 patients, which seems like it should be enough to detect the difference to me, but I'm not a statistician. Also, for some of the other patient groups who did not show statistically significant complete clearance rates, they speculate about immune immaturity for kids aged 2 to 6 and skin barrier disruption for patients with atopic dermatitis, which makes sense, but then it's harder to make the argument that, well, maybe it works sometimes for some of them, because if it's not going to work, if you're 4 years old because your immune system's not mature, then, I mean, probably you find some whose immune system is more mature and could work, but still increases the number needed to treat.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe your goal is not complete clearance. Maybe you just want way fewer molluscum, but you're okay if there's 2 or 3 left over. So the authors also examined 90% clearance rates and 75% clearance rates at week 12, and the trends were similar to the complete clearance rates. And as you might guess, it's easier to achieve not complete clearance with, again, I calculated these, number needed to treat of 6 for 75% clearance and 7 for 90% clearance. The authors also point out that improvement, but not complete clearance, was often considered successful or at least satisfying by the families. In addition, complete clearance of molluscum is like really hard. That's a really high benchmark to try to aim for, especially given subclinical and latent infections. Good news, the medicine was safe, though pain at the application site did crop up 19% in the berdazimer group versus 5% in the vehicle group. Erythema was also notable at 12% versus 1%. About 4% of patients in each group ended up with some scarring. Maybe that's just from the molluscum. We know molluscum can leave like little scars. So especially given like erythema and presumably inflammation, I'd be especially hesitant to use this medication in dark-skinned patients given the potential for post-inflammatory change and the fact that they didn't get really much better in the subgroup analysis. So overall, the results are not particularly impressive, though the medication does seem to do something. Hypothetically, based on the subgroup analysis, the ideal patient would be a white kid between age 6 and 12 who has never had atopic dermatitis and who doesn't get treatment interruption.
Yeah.
I do prefer to not treat molluscum. This study states that in general, 70% of patients are untreated. I kind of wish that number was higher, honestly. I don't think we really need to treat molluscum. But I certainly have some very motivated families sometimes, and I feel like I can empathize, especially if you've had it for like a year and you're like, I really, really hate this. That's all I can ever see when I look at my little boy. It's disgusting. Can we just get them gone? And, you know, those are patients that I treat. My go-to is usually Candida antigen injection. But this is going to be available. Whether or not I prescribe it is likely going to come down to the cost. So if this costs $5, I'll probably prescribe it a fair amount. If it costs $500, I'll probably almost never prescribe it. My guess is it's going to be way closer to $500 than to $5.
Yes, you are likely correct. New drug development is always expensive, and I know they have to offset that cost somehow, but sometimes the price points for these do seem a little prohibitive.
Well, these are humongous studies. I mean, they did 55 sites across the United States. That costs a lot of money.
It does.
It's hard for me to feel like I would prescribe a 500. I don't know how much it's going to cost, but if it costs $500, like something that costs the healthcare system $500 to treat a benign, spontaneously resolving condition. But it's cool to have something out there, and it's cool that it's got a novel mechanism of action, and hopefully, listeners, you feel armed when it is available about whether or not you want to use it.
All right.
That is all the time we have for today, friends, so thank you for joining us. Today, we learned about autoimmune progesterone dermatitis. Think about it. If you've got a female patient who repeatedly gets the same kind of itchy eruption before her menstrual period. We learned about sirolimus cream for keratosis pilaris rubra, the potential option. We learned that spironolactone does not seem to be associated with an increased risk of cancer of anything, but we learned that dupilumab might be associated with some IL-17 or 23 related diseases like psoriasis or enthesitis. And we learned about berdazimer, which has been approved for molluscum and works medium, I guess I would say.
I do like that it sounds like a dwarf from Lord of the Rings, though. Doesn't it not? Does it not? Berdazimer.
That is a major bonus.
King under the mountain.
It doesn't have a brand name yet, but I assume it's going to be Gimli.
See?
Thank you to our institutions. Thanks to the University of Utah for supporting the podcast. And thanks to Texas Tech for lending us Michelle. Thanks also to all of the members of Team Dermosphere, dedicated group of students who help keep this moving along behind the scenes. They include Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Angie Wong, Lara De La Cruz, Jordan Easterling, Austin Callister, Nicole Babkowski, Lior Lavin, and Justin Lyon. You can find us on X, Instagram, and Facebook as well, mostly thanks to Team Dermosphere. And you can also give us money. If you feel like the podcast has brought you some value and you'd like to give back, go to uofuhealth.org/dermosphere and you can donate to the cause. You can also find some of our content on video platforms such as YouTube and ViewMedi. And if you want to hang out with Michelle and I some more, you can join us for University of Utah Dermatology Echo sessions, which offer some free CME. And you can also track us down at the AAD. We're going to be providing a bunch of talks. Hopefully we'll post sort of our schedule of talks on social media or something. We don't have a booth, but we'll try to be walking around with like Dermosphere pins stuck to our backpacks or something. So feel free to chase us down and I'll try to remember to bring some pens this time.
Sounds good.
All right, friends. We'll see you guys in 2 weeks. Stay well.